Doug, addict alcoholic. It's a privilege tonight to introduce someone who I met about 9 months ago in my early recovery. He's a gentleman that he doesn't often speak at the Triangle Club a whole lot, but when he does, he's kind of like E.F. Hutton. Everybody gets real quiet and we listen because he's got some good advice for us. With that, I'd like to introduce you to Paul, who's our speaker tonight.
Maybe we could start this meeting with a prayer that my sponsor taught me. Breathe in God, breathe out me. Breathe in God, breathe out me. Breathe in God, breathe out Paul McKee. And my name is Paul McKee, and I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here. I understand this isn't a meeting. I'm telling my story. So I also had a few other things that were very, very troublesome to me as I walked this road of recovery, and I will launch and tell you what those were. It's good to be here. And darn, it's good to be sober. And it's good to have time. And it's good for those that are just starting out to see you here. I look over the crowd and I see some of you and I think, oh my goodness, it's wonderful you're here. I'm an Iowan. I was born and raised on a farm. And we had a large family, I guess, or not. There was eight of us in the family. But somehow or another, even though it was a farm and in a small town in Iowa, I never felt part. I never felt I measured up. I never, quite frankly, wanted to be a member of the family. Now, I guess intellectually I did, but my actions said differently. Those were the days. I was born in 1937. Instead of 1947, so I didn't get into drugs. I was afraid of them. It is true that I tried the twinkle eye 5 or 6 times, and I thought, who in the world will ever keep trying this? I just got paranoid as all get out. To this day, I don't know why you try it. A lot of you know it as pot or marijuana. But I found my brown whiskeys and that was all I needed. But I found that the last of the trail on what I used to walk through fear. Because I was one of these that I would stay away from the family, walk away while they were in one part of the old family and I'd be another. And I would walk the farm thinking great things. Always thinking of what I wanted to be. Or what I was going to be maybe when I get off the farm. But never once did I say, well, how am I really going to go about becoming this great thing? So I felt detached. But quite frankly, I had a normal high school, normal grade school. But I can remember one of the first things I knew was when I attended kindergarten. I don't remember a lot. That's not unusual. That I felt I still didn't measure up. I just didn't. Yeah. I did have a crazy idea that if I'd have been born maybe in Creston, maybe in Des Moines, Iowa, or Omaha, Nebraska, instead of Creston, Iowa, my life would have changed and everything would have been wonderful. But the fact is, I spent a lot of time in Omaha and it didn't change, it just got worse. I had a tremendous amount of fear in me. I don't know why. And that's one of the reasons why, that is the reason why I use my full name. It has nothing to do with anonymity or anything of that nature. When I got into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, there was me after about a week. And he said, I've got 13 years in, but I've never met anyone as fearful as you are. May I suggest you start using your full name to walk through fear? And that's what he used. I didn't realize, I knew I had a lot of fear. I didn't realize until 2 years sober, and I was attending a roundup on the Outer Banks. But one thing I had noticed, that during those early years, that if I would sit down at a place and you were sitting there, 50% of the time people got up and left and didn't come back. I'm probably being a little generous with saying 50. Maybe it was higher. And they wouldn't leave the room, that they'd sit somewhere else. And 2 years later, when I was attending this roundup, there was a lady came up to me in my home group and said, we were at dinner time, and she said, you see the table over there? I said, yes, it's all the home group people, about 13 of them or so. And she said, well, we took a vote, and we decided to invite you to the dinner. I didn't know how to take that, quite frankly, but I was glad to join them. But she said, now let me tell you, Paul, why we took that vote. And I want to tell you, Paul, why we've done this, because of what the power of Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsorship. Let me just take off for a minute. There's no way that I can express or explain the value of what sponsorship has meant to me in every phase of my recovery. I have a sponsor today. His name is Bill R. And he has a sponsor. And I sponsor people. And then they in turn sponsor people. And that's wonderful. Getting back to that, I said, well, why, Patty? And she said, Paul, you radiated so much fear and anger, we didn't care to be around you. It was uncomfortable to be around you. That was probably, I was blessed, because when I got a sponsor shortly after I got into AA, I was the only sponsoree he had. I believe he probably had enough to handle right there. But what were those things that I used to walk through this fear and to cope with life and to realize that made me part of society and made me part of at least being part of a society and the people around me? Well, I don't know when I started. That would have been a very early age. Wouldn't it have been? I used food. And now I'm a member of the Overeaters. And I've kind of slipped and slid. I've been in that program for 20 years. I'd like to say I've been absent all that period of time. I've probably been absent about 70% of the time. I can get real fluffy. You may think I'm fluffy now, but I've lost 47 pounds last few months. But it's a wonderful thing. There's a comfort in that. So I use that thing so not to face reality. See, my fear kept me from facing reality. I've had an opportunity to speak to sponsorees and their parents. And found out that a lot of these people, when they had fear, they learned very early in their teen years to find a lady or a man, depending on the situation, that they could sit down and talk to. And they walk through fear that way. It's what we do now. It's what I do now. I walk through fear by talking to you and my sponsor. I walk through fear by listening to you. But the greatest way I walk through fear is having a personal God that I know works personally in my life. Well, food wasn't enough, apparently. Because then at probably, I don't know, 9 or 10, I turned to sex. And I know the big book talks about sex problems. I have sex addiction. And I'm a member of Sex Anonymous today. And thank God. Because I can tell you right now, that was just as devastating to me as brown whiskey ever was. And today, I'm sure not suggesting it for y'all or any of you, but for over 10 years I lead a totally celibate life, and I've been in that program since March 28th of 1987. And I'm very grateful for that. And what I say, I've been in that program like the rest of them. I've gotten here by hitting the bottom and then forcibly turning it over to God to straighten out. Well, then I started to do a little work down on the farm, started to make a little money, and now guess what I used? I'm kind of like Brock Candy, mix and match it, I guess. Because I never felt part again. I had buddies in high school, eh? Sure I did, lots of them. And we had a good time. But I always never felt I equaled up to them. Couldn't go up to a lady and ask her for a date. I'd turn to my buddy and say, will you ask your girlfriend to ask so-and-so if I asked her for a date that she'll say yes, because I didn't want to get rejected. Because I had that fear again. Now, we all have that. I have a shyness. I'm still a shy individual. That's fine. I'm not a very outgoing type person. Yeah, I guess what would be known as kind of a cold fish till you get to know me. Yeah. And that's just the way I am. God has given me gifts now, and I accept them and I love them. God has given you all gifts that I used to envy. I'd say, boy, he's so charismatic. She is. You know, boy, he seems to have such a wonderful mind on him. I don't. I gotta really study to get my grades. I was always envious of what the next person had. And until I got into AA, I never saw what God gave me. Now, I'm very happy with what God gave me. Just another pretty face in the crowd. So when I started to make a little money, then what did I get into? Compulsive buying. And I had to turn that over to the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And today, I'm a cash-paying sort of a guy. Don't owe anybody anything. Won't use a credit card unless I can pay for it the very day I make a charge. So if I make a charge today, believe me, the check would have been in the mailbox before I came out here. Because I never want to get into that again. But there's such a freedom. And as God took those away and I surrendered them to God, God was able to come more into me, and I felt that. The fear level kept decreasing. And I became able to love myself and to love you all. There isn't a person in this room, and I know a few of you, but there isn't a person in this room that I realize today I love. I truly do. I'm jumping a little bit because when we got to the third step, I didn't have any problem with it necessarily, but I didn't have a God that worked personally in my life, even though I had a family that we went to church 4 and 5 times a week. We said prayers together as a family every night. But I never worked personally in my life. But now I can tell you, I have had God. Well, you might kind of think Paul went to get to drinking. Well, at age 17, guess what I found? 18, rather. No, I ain't found brown whiskey yet. Smoking. And in the end, to calm that fear, because smoking was just nothing more for me, using the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and what was presented to me by the American Lung Association. I was a 5-pack-a-day smoker. And since September 3rd of 1985, except September 3rd of 1986, I haven't had a craving for a cigarette, and I haven't had a smoke either. Now, if any of you want to quit smoking and have a difficult time, you know that was not on my power, that had to be to God, but I did. I remember that evening of September 2nd. I put that last cigarette out. I won't go through the details on how the program that I worked. But I just looked up and I said, God, it's up to you. There's no more. I can't. I don't know what else to do. But I've got to quit this smoking. It just ain't healthy, folks. And at 10:32, I still see it out that cigarette. When I woke up the next morning, I didn't have a craving. That's God. Well, I was in a family that always said, both Dad and Mom said, your education isn't through until you get a college degree. Your education isn't through, Paul, till you get a college degree. Now, quite frankly, I had no great ambition to get a college degree. But it was no thought. It was pounding in our heads from the get-go. So I thought, well, we go to college. But I was gripped by fear. Why was I gripped by fear? Because I had average grades in college. I mean, in high school, you know. But I'm thinking, oh, boy, what if I get rejected? See that rejection, I don't measure up, the fear again. That was the constant dance of my life. I'll get rejected, I don't measure up, grab fear. Well, I went to college because I had a sister going through college, and she met a dean, a man at this particular college I went to, and he said, well, I'll accept your brother if he passed the test that they use. I said, heck, I guess I go there. Because half the battle is won. I'll be accepted. So I have to learn to pass those tests. And I passed them. Not with flying colors, but I passed them. But while I was there, in 1956, April of, a friend said, let's go to have dinner. A beautiful day in Omaha, Nebraska, that international city. And we were sitting there, and I ran around in a group in college who were non-drinkers. Yeah. And he said, you know, Paul, isn't it a lovely day here in Omaha? Spring, and it was kind of warm, kind of unusual. And we sat down to have dinner, and he said, you know, I think I'll have me a drink. I said, oh. He said, would you like a drink? I said, well, I've never had one. The lady came over and said, could I take your order? And he said, yes, I'll have a Tom Collins. I went blank. I said, I'll have what he's having. It's the only Tom Collins I had. But I will admit, after I took a couple of sips of that, oh, just a couple of sips of that, everything became all right. I knew now that whatever it was that I needed in life, this was it. Liquor, alcohol. I had an instant eureka. Just absolutely instant. In fact, it was so instant that the guy I was with, I really didn't like too well, but after two or three sips, I thought he was a hell of a chap. Now, to show you what alcohol did to me, I told you I had a crowd over here that I ran around with that didn't drink. But I knew there was a crowd over here that did drink. That was on a Wednesday. I was totally obsessed for Friday to come around and to go down to this particular bar where a lot of the college folks went and drank. I immediately had a new set of friends. And those other friends that I had, I said hi to them when I bumped into them. But we never did anything together again. We never did. Well, I almost got kicked out of college twice, and you can guess what over. Alcohol, drinking. But I didn't see any problem there, because for the first time in my life, I'm starting to feel like I can be part of something. I didn't start drinking out every day, but I'd probably drink maybe 3 to 4 times a week when I first started. But by the time I ended up with getting the degree, I was drinking every day. Yeah. But hey, I always had this criteria, the dignity. By golly, we don't drink in the morning. And we don't drink in the afternoon. We drink in the evening. Now, we do drink in the afternoon if it's a holiday, Saturday and Sunday, but we don't drink. Oh, I should tell you, too, I student taught for a year, and the class was at 11 o'clock in the morning. I did have to stop to get me a short bracer, you understand, to carry me through that, mainly to get through the fear again. I didn't want to teach, but I had to teach to get through that particular degree, and I won't go in wise. I tried after that. I got out of college. I went to work for an insurance company. I didn't even know how to spell insurance. I mean, all I wanted was a job. All I wanted was a job to give me a paycheck, to put a roof over my head, some food in my belly, and what else? You know what I wanted, don't you? Some brown whiskeys. And for some of you older folks, hoochie-coochie places. You know them, younger folks know them as a little something different, but I ain't gonna say it. My life was eating, spending, pornography, drinking, and smoking. And I'm doing it at any given time of the day, so it doesn't make a whole lot of difference. Well, I got out and I was transferred to Providence, Rhode Island. And my drinking now started to take off, and I quit the job before they fired. It's really the first time I really did. Now, I justified it on the basis that I needed to get back to the Midwest. I wanted to get away from the Midwest. So I can go on and tell you that what happened was that I went from city to city. This is the 11th city I've ever lived in. I moved here down in 1987. I've lived here the longest I've ever lived. I've transferred around a lot. The height of my drinking was in Kansas City, Missouri. It's still a beautiful town. I love it. Yeah. but that was also the height of when really when it started in, let's say it started in Houston. I used to live in Houston, Buffalo. We started in Buffalo, New York. I started now to go to the sewer. Maybe some of you don't know what the sewer is. The sewer is these seedy, sodded places in life that you wouldn't tell your mama about. It's where angels didn't go. But it's for us who sank so low in the sexual area. That's where we went. The sewer. Right. God, am I glad that monkey's off. Of course, the circus is still in town, but I'm glad it's off. Then I've been something happened. I've been in San Juan. My career's gone. I've been transferred down to San Juan, Puerto Rico, to run the operations down there. My career's going like this. My insides are crashing down. I don't need to tell you it was kind of a miserable time for me. But I'm thinking my problem with this drinking and the rest of things that are going on in my life, the problem is this, is I need to get out. I'm a farm boy. I can't stand islands and eat. So I was transferred to Richmond, Virginia, and was sure that when I got there, everything would be all right. It wasn't, was it? But then an incident happened October of 1983. I was at the office, which was a rare occasion because I was kind of, didn't always stay there very long because alcohol had started to take a weight of a grip of me. And I got a phone call from my brother-in-law. My brother-in-law said, Paul, there's something I have to tell you, and I don't know why I said it. I said, oh, my God, my brother's dead. I was 46 at the time. He was 47. And he was killed in an accident, a farm accident. And what I thought about my brother was he was a selfish, self-centered, no good son of a gun. I thought he was terribly selfish. When he got married, my sister called me and said, your brother's getting married. I said, God, give my condolences to the bride. She's going to need it. But that miserable day on October 28th of 1983, I'm sitting there, and it was a cold, miserable, damp day up there in Iowa, and we're trying to get my brother buried, and I'm seeing more people coming, more people coming, more people come, and I'm saying, these people don't come out on such a miserable day like today to see some selfish son of a gun being buried. What's going on here? After the ceremony, I went up to five people. I couldn't go on any further. And I'm hearing what a kind and generous and giving man he is. And all of a sudden it hit me. I'm that selfish person. And for some reason I didn't look at myself. And I guess wanted to put it on my brother. I'm at peace with my brother. Because I've done what my sponsor told me to do to come to peace with brothers. A year later, I was coming in. I'm ending up. My last two or three years of my drinking, 2 years especially, the next door neighbor gal, she doesn't want anything more to do with me. I figured she had problems, but she was getting better and I'm getting worse. She didn't want to see me anymore. So for about 2 years, my life was pretty much sitting in a fake leather chair, drinking brown whiskey and playing Bridge Over Troubled Waters over and over. But I did go back to the church of my youth because I didn't know where else to go. And on Sunday mornings, I'd get up and go to the church of my youth. I'd go to church. Then I'd get a cup of coffee after church and I'd sit down and I would hear the preachers. I'd turn them on the TV. And I'd hear my man come from California and I'd say, boy, that's good. And I'd say, God, don't let me drink. Please, just don't let me drink. Not today, God. And then the other guy would come on, and he was from Oklahoma, and I'm saying, oh, Earl, put the words on me. You know. And Earl would get about through preaching, I'd say, someone would say, you know, I'd hear the word a little better if I just had me a drinky poo. So I'd go in and mix me a drinky poo, and I'd take a few sips, and I'm saying, Oral, I'm hearing you better now. And then another guy came in from California, and I'm saying, oh, that's a beautiful palace. I love it. Good preach him. I'm saying, yeah, I'm hearing you now. Then the guy came on from Louisiana. He's rocking and rolling by the time I'm rocking and rolling. And then at the end of that, he would say, now, if you have any troubles, emotional problems, this or that, or alcohol addiction, come on up and put your hand on the TV to get saved. You guessed it, didn't you? Sometimes I was able to get there, and sometimes I wasn't. But on September 5th of 1984, I was driving into work. I got up. I don't know why. I'm going to be at work for the first time in years. On time. And halfway through from where I lived to up there, there was a voice just like I can hear it so strongly today, folks. Tell your boss you're an alcoholic. I'm going to take care of you. Tell your boss you're an alcoholic. I got in there. He wasn't in. The voice said, sit in his room. Tell your voice you're an alcoholic. It almost sounds mysterious, doesn't it? But that's just what happened. I came in and I told my boss was an alcoholic. And the way I understand the way that went down, because, you know, I'm kind of jittery, you know. I told him I was an alcoholic. He said, Paul, we kind of felt something wasn't right. You know. He said, now this is the story, Paul. He said, it's our company policy that you go to in a treatment center. And I said, oh, I don't think I need that treatment center at all. I think I'm all right now that I've admitted I'm an alcoholic. And he said, well, now, Paul, let me do a little explaining. He said, we're going to send you to the treatment center, and the company's going to pay for it. Paul, you're going to continue to have your paycheck, and you're going to get that. And when you're through with that treatment center, you're going to have a job when you come back, and we're still going to pay you. If you don't, you're fired. I had a moment of clarity. I got in the AA, I really don't know, but I was at that point where I didn't want anymore. I didn't know what I was getting into, but when I got into that treatment center and went to my first AA meeting, something was there that said, God, there's an answer here. There's an answer here. Stick tight. I've never had a craving for the alcohol since. But I knew there was the answer. And I got a sponsor, and he led me through these steps. One of the most vital things he ever said, Paul, he asked me our first meeting, he said, well, what do you want out of AA? I looked at that sponsor. I was so desperate. I said, you know, if I can just have one night, just one night, that I can put my head on that pillow and I'm not fearful, it isn't going 1,000 miles an hour, I'll be at complete peace and serenity. He said, Paul, I can guarantee you, if you do what we say, you'll have more than those nights. And as we went on in that talk, he said, now, Paul, one of the three most important things that you and I realize that has to be done, you have to come to peace with your parents or whoever brought you up. I repeat again the word peace. Those were the words he used. You have to come to peace with the church of your youth. I am at peace with my parents. They're dead. peace with the church of my youth. I go to that church today, and as the big book says, be quick to see what people of faith have to offer. Be quick to see what your rabbi, priest, and minister has to offer. And it is such a comfort to me. I have not forgot who brought me to the dance. Oh, no. But it certainly is a great comfort to me and brings me great peace. And then he said, Paul, the most important thing, though, you have to come to death to peace with, and that's your death. And once you can come to peace with death, you'll find this journey so much easier. I think I'm at peace with death. I've had a heart attack, and I just looked up and said, Lord, that's it. We're ready. I've never been readier before. You certainly didn't. Why? I'm certainly better off than when I was drinking and waddling in the sewer and smoking a cigarette. We're ready. See, I know I have a nice mansion up there. It may be only one floor, but what the hell? Maybe all I deserve. There's so much. I've learned that the 10th step. You know, in the 10th step we read there, examination, prayer, and meditation gives us an unshakable foundation for life. I found that to be very true. It's good if I just pray. It's just good maybe if I have meditation. But if I add all of them together on a daily basis, I believe quite strongly, and that's where I'm just at, 10, 11, 12. I don't need anything. Except you all. I do need you. I do have 3 home groups. I should mention that. It's the early morning study group at the NAB Club. It's the Triangle Men's Club on Saturday at 9 o'clock at Triangle. And the Heavy Hitters that meets at Clubscape at 5 o'clock on Saturday. And I love them all. And they're all different type of meetings. I believe very, very strongly in literature-based meetings. Because that's where my answer is. One thing that the 10th step has told me, and we're getting close to the second spiritual axiom of AA, so we'll just probably quit with the 10th step when I tell you this. Restraint of pen and tongue is so important to me. The spiritual axiom is, it's a spiritual axiom that if I'm in the wrong, no matter what it is, if I'm disturbed, I'm in the wrong. I argued with that years ago, and now I find it so true. When I'm walking through the valley of fear, I don't pitch a tent. I call my sponsor. I get moving. I don't want to waddle in that. So I ask myself 2 simple questions when I'm walking through this, when I get disturbed, no matter what it is. God, let me do your will, and then I have to say, what am I fearing, and who and what am I trying to control? Usually I find my answer, don't I? I'm usually trying to control. What am I fearing, and who and what am I trying to control? The less I control, less I get control out of the life, the happier I am. The less I keep my expectations down, as my sponsor told me, keep your expectations as low as a snake's belly. And then you very seldom will be disappointed. Okay. I found out something, too, very important. I used to have an opinion on everything. I don't share it as much. People don't mind being around me when I don't do that. I've also learned one thing else. Silence cannot be misquoted. I try to live by principle today as opposed to objects. That's what the 11th step and 12th step tells me to do. What were objects I lived by? Oh, if I could have a girlfriend, if I could have this, if I could have that, if I could have a car, if I could have a knife. Do I need to go on? No. What's more important to me is my relationship with God. What's more important to me is the love that I can show you. What's more important to me, whether I want to do it or not, is service, to have some dignity, to live in harmony. I was told early on, Bill even wrote, that if I'm ever in quandary over whether to be honest or to be kind, default to kindness. They shouldn't conflict, but if they do, default to kindness. I'm not going to go on. Strictly because we have reached, I've told you, the first spiritual axiom of AA. Now we have reached that point to where there is the second spiritual axiom of AA. It's not written in any AA literature that I'm aware of, but it truly is vitally important to my sobriety, and I hope it's vitally important to yours. And it does go like this. The mind cannot absorb what the butt cannot endure. The speaker's over. Thank you so much.
Wow. Pretty good, huh? Thank you very much, Paul.